Hello, and welcome to the ninth night of Millennial 2020. This is a fun-packed evening. In 2 hours from now, I'll have Martin Lichtmess, the Austrian writer and commentator. Then Imperium Press, 2 hours after that. And 2 hours after that, The Distributist. But first, it's Faust. I don't know how you describe Faust, but he's... Yeah, well, you describe yourself.
Anglophobe extraordinaire.
Yeah, among many other talents.
Yes.
Okay, you introduce yourself to the audience.
Well, it has been a while since we've talked on a stream together, hasn't it? It's been 3 years or so. I think I was on the first or the second millennial.
Right.
But I wasn't as myself then. So, yeah, I'm Faust. I'm yes, that's my real name. I know people never believe me when I tell them that. Everyone always thinks it's a cover name, even journalists. But, yeah, no, it's my real name. And I've been involved in this sort of nationalist scene for about 5 or 6 years now, I think. And for a very long time, I wasn't really online except on other people's shows and so on. But I was more involved with real-life organizing and on-the-ground work, that sort of thing. But I decided that it would be a good idea to start doing some online content as well, because there's just basically nothing in the Netherlands for that. So I've got a YouTube channel of my own, which is in English, but that's not really where I put my best work. I put all kinds of stuff on there, thoughts I have about all kinds of things. I put poetry on there. I talk a lot about economics and technology and philosophy and religion, the sort of thing, standard sorts of things you get in our circles. But I try to always, when I talk about something, to give it something that no one else has talked about or a different perspective. Otherwise, I don't think it's of value. So if you're English speaking, that's maybe something to follow. What I really focus on, though, is Dutch content. As I said, there is basically nothing here for content in English or Dutch, for that matter, nor for the Flemish. So I have a YouTube channel called Dietse Bazuin. I'll put that in the chat if I can find the chat. But that's where I really put more edited, put-together videos. And a sort of general idea behind it was to steal PragerU's style of doing things. So, you know, we'd do it with some...
fancy graphics.
Yeah, a bit of graphics and so on. And a bit more, you know, almost a PowerPoint presentation with some talking points, where I talk a lot more about things like Hegel and conservatism and current events in the Netherlands. And under that same name, under Dietse Bazuin, I also publish a magazine for arts and history and economics again. That's my specialty, really. And for that, we have a whole team of guys together. I am the chief editor, I suppose that's the English word for it.
And yes,
we've got about 20 guys or so who on an off and on basis write stuff for it, make drawings for it. My inspiration for that really is to try to do the sort of punch magazine style of things. Although I don't have enough drawing or anything to make the sort of really quality cartoons. For now, I'm really stealing a lot of 19th century stuff for that. But yeah, if you're Dutch, we've got a recent edition about winter traditions in the Netherlands and Flanders, because this is a Greater Netherlands, as you can see by my flag, Greater Netherlands organization. We support unification. And there we talk about folklore, history, all that sort of stuff. So if you want to participate in that, send me an email. You can write in for that. And those are sort of the projects that I'm involved in at the moment.
It sounds like you should have a Linktree page where all of these things are linked. I should have asked you to do that. I've been trying to get everyone to have a Linktree because it's a very useful thing. Hopefully next year I'll build it into the application form. Well, yes, people can at least find the links to these other things from your English channel, which is the one I've linked below. So people should be able to find you easily enough. An obvious first question, just arising from what you said there, is the Greater Netherlands. What is what does that mean?
Well, it means, for a start, Flanders, so the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium. So there's a few versions of this. You've got Flanders unites with the Netherlands, which then you've got Heel Nederland, which is the entirety of Belgium and Luxembourg with the Netherlands, which is also called Benelux. And then you've got Dietschland, the greater Netherlands, which also includes parts of northern France, which used to be Dutch-speaking. Some parts still are. And whether you want one or the other is kind of up for debate, which one's practical, which one's achievable, you know. But generally, it means all Dutch-speaking people together or all Dutch historical areas together in one country. And this is the plan of that. This is the Prince of Loch.
All right. And why would you... What, you know, to an outsider who doesn't know about any of this, an obvious question might be, what is the difference between the Netherlands and Germany? Why shouldn't the Netherlands just join with Germany?
Oh, I'm the wrong person to ask that because I wouldn't mind that too much. Well, historically, we were all part of the Holy Roman Empire. The thing is, with the Treaty of Westphalia, we kind of separated and we started also down our own tree language. So back in the 15th century, Northern Germany spoke something a lot closer to Dutch. And that's kind of changed to Hochdeutsch, which is the Bavarian and Saxon and so dialect, what they speak now, Prussian. And we kind of separated there, separate state entities. You know, over time, we just kind of grew a little bit apart. We do have a lot of trade relations with Germany, of course, cultural ties. I mean, during the First World War, we were more on the side of Germany, for example, than the Allies.
Yeah, but then in the Second World War, it was very different.
Well, yeah, they invaded us. I mean, it's kind of hard to sympathize with them there, you know.
Yes, indeed. Somebody's just, sorry, I've got a technical thing to deal with here. Somebody's saying that entropy isn't down. That's because I hadn't started it yet. So now I have, and it should work. So now you'll be able to post questions for Faust, if you have any. And the link is as before, as usual. I'll post in the live chats. What would you say? And this is this is very much an outsider's question. Forgive me for this, but what would you say are the differences between the German people and the Dutch people in terms of their attitudes, their nature, their culture, etc.? Because this is something that does, as an outsider, it's something that we don't really know.
I mean, depends on the region, right? Germany isn't a country, right? It's a federal republic of 16 different countries. So if you were to ask me what's the difference between a Bavarian, a Prussian, a Saxon, or a Rhinelander, I could also go into that. And, you know, one of the difficult questions we always get asked is, what is Dutch identity? You know, you'll probably get asked this, what's English identity? I can't really tell you. I've got a complete and full answer for that. If I did, I would be telling everybody about it. But, you know, we've got our own national traits, you know, a bit of Calvinist-inspired, no-nonsense attitude, very businesslike, very independent and stubborn sort of character, entrepreneurial. I think we have one of the highest levels of entrepreneurs and independent laborers in the world, all these sort of things. So what distinguishes from the Germans? Well, you know, what distinguishes you from the English or the Scots from the Welsh? You know, there's all these little things that you only know if you live in the country and you interact with them. It's kind of hard to explain.
Yes, indeed. It's very, it's subtle. It's very difficult to verbalize. Yeah, it is a bit of a dumb question. I do apologize for it, but I wonder what people will say when I ask them that. I remember when I was in the Netherlands for, I think I've spoken, yes,
been here twice. No, you've been here three times.
I think of course, because 2016.
Utrecht, yes. In the first Ekebrand and the second or third Ekebrand conference, yeah.
Yeah, the first one was in Rotterdam, the second one was in Rotterdam, Utrecht. And then the third one was in Utrecht. Yeah, 2018, yeah. Utrecht. Yeah, that was the only time I've been in Utrecht. Yes, it was. You did say that you would like to reminisce.
Yes.
I mean, is that a chapter in your life that's now closed, that's now over?
I don't, I'm not currently involved with any on the ground activities anymore. There's things happening. I mean, I wanted to get into this a bit later about current events and politics in the Netherlands, so on. So maybe I'll get into that a bit later. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening, but like the more sort of what we would used to call the alt-right sort of thing, that's really a lot less, and it's really changed to different things, and I guess everywhere has, right? there's no organization really calling itself alt-right anymore, and there's not as much cooperation or anything like that, which is actually a good way to get into what I did want to talk about a little bit, which is, I think, the direction this movement and all the thing is going in. And my, like, one of the reasons I got started making content in Dutch and making content as a Dutch guy in English is because I really think we need to get a bit away from this over-focus on America. I mean, not only as a movement, I mean as a culture in general. People in this country, and probably in the UK, know how the Congress works in the United States. They know how the Senate works. They don't know who their mayor is. They don't know how their provincial districting works. They don't know what a waterschap is here. They know more about the politics of America than here. They know more, they import talking points. Like when that whole thing with the rioting happened in the United States, there were demonstrations here too. The Dutch police kill about 5 people a year, and that's in a bad year. And it has nothing to do with what happens here, but there were 5,000 to 6,000 people demonstrating in Amsterdam because of all the institutional racism of the Dutch police.
That's incredible. That's just amazing. And it reminds me of when you and I were in, I think it was Amsterdam, and there was the Women's March. And
oh, yes.
I couldn't help thinking, what on earth do Dutch women have to complain about in terms of, you know, emancipation? What do they not have that they want to have? It's just absolutely crazy. Same thing with BLM. What on earth could we do for black people that are already doing?
Our culture is dying because we can't get away from the Americans. Our universities in the Netherlands don't give higher education in Dutch anymore. It's all in English. And
that's an aspect of globalization, of course. It's not, I mean, but it's centered on America.
Yeah, I blame the Americans for that mostly. I mean, so as a movement, it's both as a culture and as a movement. And I think since we are nationalists and we are sort of shepherds of the culture, or should be in a way. This is why I publish a cultural magazine and why I write pieces about culture and history and arts, because that's the embodiment of it, and that needs to be transmitted to people. And I focus, for example, on children's stories as well for parents because of that. We kind of forget our own stories and our own history if we don't focus on that. So if we make content, I think we should make content for our own people, from the perspective of our own people. And one thing I don't like, for example, is, and this is also an influence imported from America, is all these shows that just talk about the weekly news. Like sometimes, like, you need one per country or so who talks about the weekly news. You need to have someone giving the news from a dissident perspective. But that's just what everyone does. And no one really makes that much more content. And I've met everyone in this movement by now. Like, I've written for Countercurrents in the past. I've met you, Greg Johnson. I've dined with Jared Taylor several times. Yeah, I've sparred with the Golden One. Frody, I've drunken beers with Frody. You know, I've talked with, met with, interacted with a lot of these people in this movement. And on the whole, you know, the Americans are great at one thing, which is marketing and communication. Like, they dominate the online scene. Even in the national scene, they dominate it. And we are really very, well, you English, you know, I'll say British, I guess, you have a reasonable amount of content. I think you've got some hope going there, but there's very little else on the continent. On the other hand, on the ground, if you go to Moldova, they'll have a better organized nationalist movement than the Americans have. You know, every country in Europe has nationalist politics, has better organized underground movements, activists. We're much better at that. But we can learn from the Americans is to do these podcasts, is to do this online content, is to do this marketing. We can learn that from them. But we need to make it for ourselves and stop, you know, talking about American news, American events. And I think we should really take a leading role in that as sort of, like I say, shepherds of culture.
I agree. I do think that it's a shame that, you know, when I survey the YouTube landscape, the online social media landscape, looking for guests for Millennial each year, I would like to have something that represents Italy, something that represents the Netherlands and Germany and, well, France. But it's very difficult to find anything. And I think that's a shame. And I don't really understand. Well, I mean, yes, there's YouTube censorship, and that's why I don't narrow it down to just YouTube.
There is stuff, but, like, I speak French and German, so I know a little bit about those movements. But even there, Firstly, it's quite insular, so the French only make content for the French. You've got, for example, Institut Iliade, Robert Stoikers, you've got the Nouvelle Droit. In Germany, you've got Verlag Antaios. Well, you've got Martin Lichmes from Austria, which I would consider German, for example. So their stuff, but they mostly focus on their own countries in their own language, so you don't know about it.
Yes, indeed. And of course, that would create a problem, because I would need them to speak in English for Millennial. And then that seems to defeat the point in a way, because then it becomes a central, it's Anglospheric again. And but yeah, the Millennial is obviously going to be that, because I am, you know, British.
Well, we can go and be ahead of the curve and we start in Han Chinese next year.
Well, the other thing about this, which is the other side of this argument, is, and this is a genuine dilemma that I have, genuine question that I have been wrangling with for since definitely the middle of 2017, because I remember doing a video then about this, and that is, and maybe you can give your perspective on this. I am a nationalist in the sense that I want life to be meaningful, and I want society to be meaningful and to serve the people, and not, you know, people shouldn't just be seen as economic units and consumers. There should be something for them to be, something for them to aspire to, and so on. That transcends their own lifespan. But I'm not necessarily a nationalist in the sense that I think here's the problem. There's already been so much mixing between European nations and genetically, and we live in a culture which is extremely it's up for mixing things together.
This is one of the reasons I'm an active advocate of Anglophobia and Francophobia.
Yeah, I wondered, because obviously this is a real problem. I mean, I actually in young British people, especially English and Scottish people, the young, like in their teens and early 20s, I can actually hear an American twang to their accents that they are probably not even aware of.
It's even worse here.
It's just normal, you know?
They use English here all the time. It's even worse.
Yes, I remember actually being with you and some of your colleagues in 2017, and we went to a bar, and your colleague tried to order a drink, and the girl behind the bar said something like, "In English, please," and
that's furious.
Yeah, and I remember your colleague said, "In my own fucking country."
In Amsterdam, the wait staff is all international. You can't really get a drink in Dutch, indeed, because all students and exchange and whatever imports from whatever. I mean, in my work, I deal with a lot with Polish guys, for example. On the other hand, you know, I think we should have sort of a mutual dislike but cooperation. Sort of my attitude. Like whenever I encounter English people online, I start harassing them about historical things and so on. Primarily because I really get a kick out of their reaction, because they can never deal with it. They always get very angry that someone's attacking them who is not, you know, leftist or non-white or whatever. But also because I think that sort of amity also reveals a sort of a mutual respect, because we know what we're on the same level, and we're, in Dutch we would say gewaagd aan elkaar. I'm not sure how you'd say that in English. But I think we should work in something like European Union, not this current European Union, obviously, with politics and science and all that. But I think that if we want to, for example, like I talk about, take the culture back and the global preeminence from the Americans, we need to have a sense of a strong Europe, and that includes economical and militarily, but primarily cultural. And I think we're capable of far better culture than the Americans. I haven't watched a movie in ages, but whenever I see ads or anything like that from these movies about comic book heroes or whatever, I just...
Oh, they're awful. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. You know, that seems to be what Hollywood has devolved into. It's just this endless drivel. It's very big budget, very expensively made shit. It's just fucking rubbish.
I see that Samuel Goggs in the chat. I was on his channel once to talk about this, and I'm not sure I made the point entirely, but in my opinion, America did have a European high culture at one point. You know, I like Poe, and I like Jack London and Melville and so on. And I think they had their own theater, their own literary tradition, their own poetry and so on. But that kind of died in the 1920s because of, well, economic reasons, really. They were completely taken over by big business. Maybe the 1930s with Roosevelt. I'm not sure when you could exactly put the death of American high culture, but I think American high culture has definitely died a death, and it's not coming back. And I don't see any effort from nationalists to make culture or to focus on their own culture or to preserve their own culture from the Americans. I can't think of a podcast that talks about American frontier literature or American whaling, like in Melville. I can't think of anything like that. I mean, Johnny Appleseed, the folk tales and things like that. I know, I think I'm talking more about it now than I've ever heard an American talk about it, for example.
That I think that's to do with the types of people who are attracted to nationalism when it's a dangerous thing to be involved with. And it still is, for sure. It's still very dangerous. I mean, it's risky. And so the types of people who tend to be attracted to it are those with less to lose in terms of a professional career, a reputation, and so on. So it tends to be working class guys, and they tend not to be into high culture.
This is a problem I've really noticed. Like secularized, I've been at this for several years, online, offline, politics, activism, all kinds of stuff. And I've really noticed that the people who are the most eager to take action, who are the most eager to take risks, are generally not the most successful or most intelligent ones. Which damages it? You only have to, I mean, to use the American example, just look at what they did with the plastic helmets guys. What are their names?
I can't remember. Yes, but I can't remember.
Shame of a good German name, to be honest, but good. These people are willing to take action, but they're not the people who should be, because we're in a stage where we need to be a vanguard, to produce intellectual content, and to mainstream ideas. You're not going to mainstream ideas by people who are overweight and shouting and dressed like carnival clowns. That's what I see happening everywhere, really. The middle-class people, the educated people, very few of them are willing to take a risk. I'm a university educated. I've always used my own name and my own face, but I'm also a person who's extremely, I like conflict. I like a challenge like that. So I've always found it fun, you know, and I've had a lot of trouble because of it. I've been fired due to political activism. I've been, whenever there needs to be someone called out in the papers for a far right, whatever, I usually get brought up. So it does cost you, but it's not impossible, to be honest, to be of a middle-class lifestyle and to be an open a nationalist, which is something I want to bring up about the Flemish movement. I have here the pamphlet.
Before you get into that, yeah. I think that what you've just said is extremely important because I think that that is something that you should spread far and wide, like how to have a middle-class life, how to you don't have to end up living on welfare if you go this route. I think how to maintain a middle-class lifestyle and still be outspoken about this stuff. If you could explain that to people in a concise, clear way, I think that would be very good for the movement.
I think it depends on your own country, really. I can't speak.
I don't mean right now. I mean in your own work, because and I would help to disseminate it, because obviously it's something you need to think about. But yeah, that is something that's crucial, because the types of people who are in, and this is something that's definitely come home to me recently, the types of people who are in a milieu will affect what happens in that milieu. You can't expect rules or procedures or whatever to override the nature of the people involved.
I'm afraid we just have to be a bit elitist at the moment. And, you know, people on the ground do good stuff. They can do good work. We've got a charity organization here in the Netherlands, for example, called Heart for Eigen Volk, Heart for Our Own People. I made a promo video on Dietse Bazijn about it if you want to go check it out. They do things like they help poor natives with Christmas and New Year's for celebrations, with food help. They organize legal defense for activists, all these sort of things. And this is, you know, mostly a working class movement, these guys. So you can do good stuff. But again, the context in the Netherlands is different than in America. I think you get a lot more repression in the United States. I mean, it's like, you know, you're in Rome, you're in Imperial Rome. Of course, the Praetorian Guard is closer by to come and punish you.
Yes. And you once told me that Antifa are basically inactive in the Netherlands. Is that still the case?
As a street movement, it's basically gone. They still have their journalists, they still have their information groups, so they can still damage you in the press. But it used to be, like, I know people who've been in the Dutch nationalist movement since the 70s and 80s, and it used to be, you know, you went to a nationalist event, you could be fired at in a bus. There were several terrorist attacks. I don't think anyone was ever killed, but, well, Pim Fortuyn was killed, obviously, but a lot of, they're playing a lot of people injured. It used to be quite dangerous to be an outspoken nationalist in the Netherlands. And these days, it's really been normalized a lot because we've had several, I mean, killing Pim Fortuyn was really a bad move on their part because it made him a huge martyr and it really caused a wave of right-wing reaction. And now we've had Wilders and we've had Baudet and several others for years. And they've really normalized it. Like, I think in terms of, like, the discussion in the public sphere, the Netherlands is one of the most right-wing countries in Western Europe because you can really openly say a lot of things that would land you in serious trouble in Germany or England or Sweden, maybe even France. Like, you could, blaming everything on the Muslims is perfectly fine, for example.
That is an interesting point because it does seem to me that blaming everything on the Muslims and going on and on about Muslims is something that was really for 2014, 15, 16, and beyond. Then it got taken over by, in the British context, it got taken over by the likes of Tommy Robinson, who are explicitly Civnats. And the Ethnats moved on to, you know, actually talking about race. And Islam sort of fell by the wayside, which is interesting because it's still a social force that, as much as it ever was, and more than it ever was.
Over here, you can be as xenophobic as you like, as long as you make it about Muslims. It's really quite impressive what you can get away with. Even in, I mean, just saying things online, obviously you can say, but even in like polite discourse, if you are with a colleague and you talk about hating Muslims, and a random white guy passes by, he'll be like, yeah. Get them out, you know. No, like hatred for especially Moroccans is very normal.
That's amazing. In Britain, it's still completely, I mean, in Britain, I, you know, it's embarrassing because I realize how much we are the bitch of America in various ways. And one of them is this culture of egalitarianism and multiculturalism.
I found it interesting that there's so much fiction from decades and decades ago, like Alan Moore's V for Vendetta, you know, all the standard ones, about England becoming a totalitarian top police state. And apparently they were really getting at something because you're really moving in that direction. Seems like they detected a trend in the culture there.
It's so interesting because, you know, on the one hand, we're supposed to be this individualistic, freedom-loving, liberty-loving people. But we're really good at oppression, oppressing ourselves. You know, the BBC, the Ministry was the model for the Ministry of Truth. And I see it also in America. You know, on the one hand, America is guns and freedom and all that. But I can easily imagine America becoming a totalitarian state. It doesn't seem
indirectly. I think in Britain, it would be a lot more explicit. I think it is already a lot more explicit. You know, with police beating you down and everything, and visiting you for Facebook posts, I think it's a lot more explicit in the UK with all the cameras and everything. In America, it would be more, you know, cultural, more, you know, subtle pressure, like we're locking you up for your own good and sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Well, in Britain, I mean, I think that Britain might be the worst country to be in just now for in terms of saying controversial things of any nature, not just against Islam or against, you know, other ethnic groups or whatever, but in every way, I think. And I noticed this change in early 2018, and I did a video at the time called Anarcho-Terrorist Britannia. It was just before I moved back over here, so it had a special titles intro because, you know, back then I was, yeah. Anyway, And I noted the thing there because it was just before I moved back here and I was nervous. I was thinking, what the fuck am I going to be?
I remember you were really worried about
I was. And so, like, for example, I I did various things. I took various precautions when I moved over, when I came over here, in order to avoid just problems at the airport and so on. Because I thought, what on earth am I? And it's not that far-fetched at all, because recently that has happened. You know, people who I know have been interrogated at the airport upon landing back in Britain. You know, so they're at that stage where you haven't committed a crime, they don't have any suspicion that you've committed a crime, but they're just doing it to intimidate.
Yeah, we had a case of a journalist getting a call from his local police officer about an interview he did about someone who he had some conspiracy theories about the coronavirus. So the police called the journalist. The journalist put this online, broadcasted it, and it was a huge backlash against the police, you know, because everyone's like, well, this is not the job of the police to do any top policing. So I think it'll be quite hard to get anything like that going here, but it'll happen. It'll just be slower, you know, as long as these things get normalized in the countries around us. It'll be imported. They've already amended our constitution so that offending gays is illegal.
So do you think it's going to get worse then? In the coming years.
And if all things staying the same, of course it's going to get worse.
So something
doesn't change.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but I'm just wondering, how can we maintain? I mean, this is on the one hand, I've said basically everything that I want to say about nationalism and so on. And I do genuinely, and I have for like 3 years now, wanted to get away from it as a topic, yeah. But various things keep bringing me back to it. But I, on the other hand, I want it to continue to have a future, and I don't know. I really think that we're going to have to become far more intelligent about what we do, and we're going to have to think much bigger as well. I mean, just appealing to populism isn't going to work. Appealing to the authorities obviously isn't going to work. I think we need to actually be at the level of, we need to be thinking about building entirely new institutions that are bulletproof against being infiltrated or whatever. And that, honestly, that's probably going to, in order to do that, I think it's going to require building our own economic system.
Speaking of institution building, like Millennial is sort of an institution at this point. It's like if you were a car manufacturer, at the end of the year, you show off all the new car models people can go and buy. So yeah, it's a good show for nationalism, and it spreads, you know.
Yes, but when I say institutions, I mean society at large. I mean, obviously, it's nice that you say that, and thank you. But what I mean is, we're actually going to need our own like civil rights organizations, our own advertisers, everything. So yes, you've been brandishing that pamphlet for a long time. I will keep my own views on this back for a video next year. In the meantime,
you've never been to the Eisenbahn, have you?
No. No.
Okay. I did for Red Eyes a video documentary of the Eisenbahn of 2017. It's on my channel if people want to watch. It's all the way in the back, together with some interviews on Russia Today and other stuff I did. But the Eisenbahn is the biggest nationalist event in the Netherlands, the Netherlands, the Greater Netherlands, because it's in Flanders, which, of course, if you ask me, that's the Netherlands. And what they have, for example, this is a pamphlet of the event. Here you've got a memorial for veterans of the Second World War. And a few pages over, you'll have a politician. Let's see if I can find him here. You've got a politician of the Vlaams Belang advertising the same pamphlet. You'll have here one of the magazines, at Politica, of the Flemish Nationalist Movement. Health and Birth Service Help. This is a health insurance company for Flemish nationalists.
That sounds good. That's the kind of thing that we need. Yeah.
In the same pamphlet here, you've got a housing salesman advertised for Flemish nationalists.
Fantastic.
Art, guys who make art to sell for nationalists.
Fantastic.
Here you've got the youth organization, which is sort of the scouts, the VNJ, Vlaams Nationale Jeugd, which is nationalist scouts.
God, I can just imagine how that'll get demonized.
Oh, yes.
It'll start with, they're not letting in gay paedophiles, and it'll end with, it's just like the Hitler Youth.
Well, you see, the Flemish movement doesn't have that much trouble with that, because they're quite solid. They've got institutions that are a century old. They've got representation in Parliament. They're quite closed, and they're a bloc. So you try to get in, you're just not going to get in. So activists, this is the uniform sort of activist movement, because they're allowed flags and uniforms in Flanders still. What else? Well, political party in Flanders. Here you've got a car company advertising in this brochure.
There's so it's not like a nationalist car company.
Yeah. Well, it's a garage for nationalists. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Music events. Well, anyway, if you want to have an impression of what that event looks like, you can go all the way back on my channel, have a look at it. It's a short little 12 minutes, I think, documentary about it. It attracts between 4,000 to 6,000 people most years. And this is really the model of how things should start to be organized in nationalist circles. The Flemish movement is really an example of that. Of course, they complain that they're weakening, but they, you know, they've got two political parties: one which is really, really hardline nationalist, one which is a little bit less, the N-VA and the Vlaams Belang. They've got student unions, Catholic student union, nationalist student union, which are both very conservative. They are very well organized. Of course, it's taken them about a century to build this. And it took basically a majority of, or at least a significant amount of the Flemish population just supporting them. You'll see Flemish flags hanging in places. There'll be cafes expressingly nationalist. You know, it's a culture that's been created there. And the culture's been created by dissemination of information in the first place through culture. It started in the trenches of the First World War with the soldiers, Flemish soldiers who felt they were being mistreated by their French officers. And then intellectuals picked it up. And then there's all kinds of books and...
No, it doesn't matter. I just came up with a crap pun. So, how would
this is the model.
So, what can you tell me the name of it again? Because I've forgotten.
The event is called the IJzerwaken, which is the wake at the River IJzer, which is a memorial service in principle for the fallen of the First World War. And the organizations in it are Voorpost, Vlaams Nationaal Jeugdbelang, KVHV, NSV, a number of organizations.
Right. Okay. So that is something that obviously that should be spread as far and wide as we can spread it. But also, it sounds like it would be it's a ready-made template for other countries to emulate.
The only thing it requires is people to have the guts to step forward and start organizing. So the thing is, like, this is Flanders, right? This is Flanders, southern Netherlands. In the Netherlands, we also have organizations. But it's like we've got the skeleton set up to get things started, but we don't have enough people and enough support, especially finances and so on, to really be on the same level as the Flemish. And one of the things, like I talked about earlier, about the least appropriate people being the most willing to take action. The other problem is that a lot of the people who share these sentiments, who are middle class, aren't willing to really make any sacrifice, which isn't even making donations or supporting financially other organizations who do things, you know. And
well, this is fine. I need to go on
that barrier. Hold on.
I'm guessing that's because they're scared of their credit card donations being tracked, and then the authorities find out that they are supporting nationalism.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what the risk is. See, the Netherlands, I know about this case in the UK where people lost their bank account. It's illegal to do that in the Netherlands. The banks have to supply you a bank account. They can't do that to you. So the biggest risk is that you might be out as having supported a nationalist group, but it would require your bank leaking information, which would be a huge scandal, you being incredibly careless about what you talk about to whom, or Antifa pulling something with hacking bank registers, which would be also a huge scandal. So I don't see what really the risk is. Just financially supporting, voting for things, you know, that's the minimum you can do to support things, which is pretty much without risk.
I think it's probably to do with the government finding out that you've supported, because then you'll be on some kind of list. You might not be able to, to get on flights. I don't know. I'm trying to think what the fear is, but I know that there are professional people who are terrified of they will not use like a credit card or something to donate.
Tell me about it. I meet these people all the time. They'll send me messages. I'll talk to them, but they think it's a heroic act to talk to me. because I'm this scary known person in who's in the papers and so on. And you know, that's one of the things that has to be broken, this fear of this just fear of everything, really.
Yes, and I think the best thing that we can do to in that regard is to just put ourselves forward and say that we are sane people. We are not bad people. We are not, we can speak properly and so on. We're civilized. We're not monsters. But in order to do that, we need a platform. And now you and I still have YouTube, but I'm pretty sure that won't last forever. And that is why we need our own video sharing website, but that website needs to be high quality. All of this requires money. Something that I've realized is, and you know, this is obvious to anyone with any common sense, goodwill isn't enough, talent isn't enough, even connections aren't enough. You do need money. So money makes things happen. It's as simple as that.
The thing is, if like you've got 50,000 subscribers, if 10% of that each donated €5 a month to an organization, that would be quite a cash flow for any currently existing group. Same goes for any group. I think, for example, in the history of the Flemish movement and in Dutch nationalism and so on, one of the ways that they would organize funds is by publishing a magazine and just having have subscribers pay for the magazine, charge a relatively high price, and those finances would go back into the movement. And another thing they would do is, of course, represent business interests, but that's quite hard to do these days.
Oh, indeed. Some people are talking about my T-shirt, and I didn't introduce my T-shirts for the last few nights because people were objecting to me doing so. However, this one is actually relevant to this hangout because it's Clarence Boddicker from RoboCop, and the infamous scene where he says the bitches leave catchphrase.
Which is directed by a Dutch guy.
Exactly. That's the connection. That's how I justified saying this. It's Paul Verhoeven who is Dutch and a very talented guy. But you don't like him very much, do you?
No, he's very leftist. See, the thing is with RoboCop, it's a satire on police state. It's of right wing who want a police state. And the same with Starship Troopers. It's a satire of a fascist state. You see, the thing is, something I always find very, very funny is that Warhammer 40,000 was made as a satire of right-wing views. Judge Dredd was made as a satire of right-wing views. But then you'll always have a whole bunch of right-wing people going, that's awesome, let's do that. And then it just fails as a satire because people unironically want that. It's like the people who vote in Bolsonaro and Bolsonaro says, let's go shoot all the criminals. And everyone is like, yes, let's go do that. It's like, how can you satirize that, you know?
Yeah, I saw the producer of RoboCop saying that it was fascism for liberals. In other words, it's a sort of guilty pleasure that even liberals enjoy watching. A rapist getting his dick shot off by the law. Even liberals enjoy seeing the bad guy get his just desserts. So it's a way for them to get that, but still tell themselves that, of course, I wouldn't advocate this in reality. It's the same way that they love J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter, the British private school tradition.
Yes,
they love Jane Austen and all the rest of it, but they will do everything they can to destroy these things in real life.
There's a French psychologist, I have his name saved here somewhere, Jean Baudrillard, and he says that stereotypes have kind of frozen in place somewhere in the 1920s or 30s. And you see that in things like Harry Potter, which is extremely white. It's a boarding school from the 30s, basically. And you see this in romance novels and all these things. It's like fairy tales in a slightly more modernized age. And it's completely European in its values, its aesthetics, its perspectives. But, you know, these same people who watch this, who love this, they'll go on about, oh, we need to tackle systemic racism and all that.
Indeed. Okay, I'll ask you some questions from the... was there anything else that you wanted to talk about before we get to the questions?
Not specifically. Again, just, you know, if you're Dutch or Flemish and you want to write stuff, you want to produce videos, if you want to lend your voice to voicing videos, then contact me on Dietse Bazaan. And I think we can fill the rest of the time with questions about analysis, because whenever I come on a stream, people always want to ask about stuff happening here in politics and so on.
Yeah. And also, do you have a Telegram channel or a Telegram group?
I'm not on Twitter. I've been banned from Twitter.
All the more reason you should have a Telegram thing then. In fact, I'm just saying, it was you who first introduced me to Telegram back in, was that 2017, late 2017?
16 or 17. Yeah. We used it as a safe way to communicate, yeah. Yeah, I don't use it to events like that because I don't really, it's a long story. There's a lot of reasons I don't use social media in that way anymore. That's something that I did want to say is, I'll probably be safe on YouTube, on at least in my Dutch content, because no one at YouTube speaks Dutch, until political change happens in the Netherlands. Like when Wilders or someone becomes huge, they'll start kicking out everyone who speaks Dutch from YouTube, which is just me. So that'll be easy.
All right, so let's get to the questions. I mean, I don't know. I feel like we should talk more about what we were saying about institutions, because I feel that's such an interesting and useful, important topic. And there's so much more that I could say about it. But yeah, I'll just leave that for my own video in the new year. All right, so let's get to some questions then. What are some things that average Dutch citizens can do to help the movement? How can we get in touch with each other?
Well, Twitter is probably the most used platform by Dutch nationalists, at least by the more serious ones. You've got Discord, but Discord's full of trolls. I guess like one of the ways is to just follow my stuff, and from there you can find others. I plan to organize as soon as we can, when this COVID stuff is over, to start organizing some open conferences and speeches. And otherwise,
I'm guessing that would just be for Dutch speakers.
Yeah, no foreigners allowed, obviously.
Quite right.
You just want another trip to the Netherlands? Come and check out the Amsterdam canals. We've been to the red light district to observe. We didn't do anything. I wanted to show him.
I want to emphasize, I don't like Amsterdam for the damn red light district, right? That's the least. I love Amsterdam as a city, and I know you don't, but I do. I love the atmosphere, the architecture, it's a really nice city. But I know that to you it's a badge of shame. I know that Utrecht struck me as a more civilized Amsterdam.
Yeah, it kind of is, but it's becoming more and more like Amsterdam. I think if you want to have like the pretty Dutch architecture, the canals and the Gothic brickwork and so on, your best bet is like Leiden or Groningen, which is a little bit better, but also becoming more diverse. Student cities, you know, student cities are ruined by the students.
Of course, crazy young lefty twats. I do agree with what you said about Discord, by the way. It's a fucking cesspit. All right. Woes and Faust, I wrote on the need to coordinate the various assets of both American and European nationalists. Present-day American leaders do not work for a strong Europe, but nationalism does.
I don't think, I've said this many times, I don't think a nationalist America is in our favor either, because I think they wouldn't really want to abandon their position of preeminence in the world, and I want Europe to be the preeminent world power. So in my opinion, America collapsing is a desirable thing. It'll free us from cultural imperialism. It'll free us to be our own culture, our own defense, our own economics.
Okay, I'm not going to agree or disagree with that, because I do see the point. I mean, in fact, I've actually said it myself, that as long as America is this hegemon, it can nuke a European country that's going nationalist. So, yeah, it's not good for anyone. Does free speech in the Netherlands...
Is this about the Holocaust thing?
Yeah.
Okay, so in 2012, our liberal, I emphasize economically liberal, like a sort of classical liberal party, which has been the biggest party for decades... They decriminalized denial of the Holocaust because they were just that much in favor of free speech. And these are not nationalists who did that.
That's interesting. I know that there are people who genuinely aren't, who are just pro free speech, who will allow things about the Holocaust and so on, and then that gets used against them, and they're accused that they must be anti-Semitic and Holocaust deniers themselves. Otherwise, they wouldn't allow it. Of course.
There's not really a point to doing it. I don't understand why people focus so much on it, but yeah.
Well, that's a debate in itself.
Let's not.
Yeah. My work addressing these issues, Foundations of the 21st Century, is now banned on Amazon. See it on archive.org. So, okay, that's Frank De Silva.
That's working from the Grundlage der 1900 of, what's that Germanophile Englishman? Campbell? I think Campbell. And then you've got the mid of the 20th century, of course. So I guess we do need a 21st century, but it's a bit early in the century to start writing about it, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, you're saying Foundations of the 21st Century, I guess.
Yeah, Grundlage der 1900s is a famous book in German nationalism written by an Englishman who was a huge Germanophile.
Yes, I was hearing about it a few weeks ago. Well, anyway, this guy has written this book and it's banned, but you can find it on archive.org. Foundations of the 21st Century by Frank De Silva. All right. Are the Scottish, this is for me, are the Scottish, well, first of all, you can answer it for the Dutch. Are the Dutch lost to globalism / communism?
A significant amount is. So in the Netherlands, we've had a tradition called verzuiling, where we would have our own separate institutions for each societal group. So the socialists would have their own trade unions, their own publications, their own political parties. The Calvinists would have their own. The Catholics would have their own, the liberals would have their own. And my hope is that we're, and I'm seeing this happening, is that we're sort of moving back to that. So we'll have the nationalist Zyl pillar, in which we have our own publications and our own. And the people who will survive are those who embrace the nationalist pillar and stay within it and have enough hatred for the leftists and the rest and so on to just not interact with them, as we used to do in the 50s, basically.
Right. As for are the Scottish lost to globalism, communism, I think for now, yes, but only for now. I mean, that doesn't mean that I think they're permanently lost to it, but I think that they're definitely going to have to make this mistake for the foreseeable future. But of course, the Scots are very good at pretending to do something. I mean, right now they're anti-English and they're pro-EU, but once, I think if it actually came to it, would they vote for independence? Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. Would they vote to go back into the EU? I don't think they would. So I don't think they would go, because it's obviously stupid. It's obviously an insane thing to do.
I think you're a bit tied with the rest of the Anglosphere. Whatever happens maybe there is going to involve you. One thing I find interesting about Scotland is you've got a lot more YouTubers than us, and you've got about like a third of the population that we have.
Well, I can't explain that, but it is strange. That's my show. I think in the short term, yes, they are, but it's not a permanent condition. Okay, Faust, what are your feelings or resentments towards Australia and England for our respective roles in the Boer War?
Oh God, I want reparations. New reparations. Now, the Boer War, like, that's one of the things, like I say, I'm kind of Anglophobic. It's mostly banter, but there is something there. Because, yeah, the Boer War did kill, like, 20,000 women and children, and it was a completely immoral war where you just were just conquering them for gold. And I don't usually complain about colonialism because, you know, that's an us versus them thing, but when it's between European people, I think that's a more severe sort of thing. And I think English have really been, because of their position of power in the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, kind of mistreated a lot of other European peoples, and the Boers, one of the worst examples, really. So, yeah, I would want at least an apology.
All right. I won't give it to you on this stream because I don't want to speak.
But you're Scottish, you can sort of pretend it's the English's fault.
Okay, all right, I'll do that. All right, this is a weird one. I don't know if this is a genuine question or not. You talked about using sperm donation and massive families to spread nationalist genes, and someone has been going on about it on Telegram. Do you still think these study-derived nationalist genes are real? And is this a good strategy in theory?
Are you talking to you or to me?
Because I don't know. I've never said. I talk
a lot about eugenics. I talk a lot about transhumanism and technology and how technology is going to fundamentally change reproduction, how it's fundamentally going to... See, evolution never stops, and right now we're in an evolutionary bottleneck where the people who are able to handle modernity are reproducing, and when we come out of this bottleneck, Europeans will be deprived of a lot of traits that make them European. I think empathy will disappear from our gene pool. I think there'll be selective pressures which will move us in a direction which we aren't currently. The people who can handle living in a city and still have children and who can deal with being on welfare and have no problem with that, they'll be successful, they'll reproduce. And in the end, though, only the amount of babies actually counts. And also, we're seeing a lot of developments with CRISPR, we're seeing a lot of developments with gene editing. We're at the stage where we can have animals, and specifically sheep, mature for most of their gestation period outside of the womb of the mother in artificial wombs. Only the fertilization hasn't been achieved yet. So we're seeing this sort of thing. We're going to see drastic changes. This is one of the things I talk a lot about my channel, how technology, how nationalists ignore technology too much, how much technology is going to change the paradigm of society. And I think what the guy's talking about is I talked about sperm selection. About how you can, through sperm selection, start optimizing humans. They're already doing this in China. I think that's what he's talking about. So, yeah, but if you want to know those things, go on, check out my channel. I have some videos on that.
Yeah. Of course, I had E. Michael Jones on last night, and he was saying that genes have, he doesn't think they have any real effect on behavior, which I don't know how he can say that, how he can believe that. It's amazing.
Someone said JF would eat him for dessert. I've read JF's book. JF's book's actually been one of the reasons that I got convinced that he was right about the phenotype change. I just don't think that he's right. We can stop it.
Right, okay. Would Faust perhaps talk a little about what happened to the FVD? And do you see any parallels between them and what happened to the AFD in Germany?
Kind of. So what happened is everyone knows Wilders, right? Wilders is internationally known. He's been in parliament for 9 or 20 years now, and he's still the leader of the biggest, pretty nationalist Dutch party. I mean, he wants to close the borders, deport, remigration. He wants to close all mosques, ban the Quran. He's got some pretty good positions. For a lot of our nationalists here, he's not good enough, but he's pretty good. And we have another party which started 3 years ago called Forum voor Democratie. And they're sort of mixed. They wanted to launch a national liberal sort of idea, which is stupid, but whatever. And they had, on some things, more radical standpoints. There was a big scandal involving them about race and IQ in 2017 or 18. And there was a big thing about me talking with the party leader and being at one of the events. And I've been dragged into this a couple times. But essentially, they were a little bit more nationalist than Wilders, especially on a more philosophical basis. They talked about Welbeck. They talked about some sort of MGTOW talking points about the relation between the sexes, these sorts of things. And this, of course, attracted a lot of our guys into their ranks who couldn't keep their autism in check, unfortunately. So they started spamming all kinds of dumb memes in chat groups. As I understand it, I'm not entirely sure about all the facts and details, but the story was journalists and no, the story was a bunch of liberals within the party were getting very annoyed with all the nationalist stuff, all the race jokes and all that in chat groups. And they tried to get these people kicked out by sending a message to the party top with all the messages they had found and saying, this is unacceptable, it has to go. The party top said no. And they leaked it to an Antifa group who leaked it to the press. The press created a scandal. This was in May. Then this kind of died down until last November when suddenly a part of the party leadership tried to basically coup, have a coup d'etat inside the party. The liberals wanted to kick out the more nationalist side, and the more nationalist side included the party leadership and the more intellectual and the most well-known politicians as well. This was a bit of a fight within the party for about a week, and eventually the nationalists sort of won because the liberals decided to give up and left and formed their own party. And now Forum for Democracy has been pretty much decimated. They'll probably still get a few seats next election, which is in March. We have elections in March, which will be interesting. And unfortunately, the hope for from our side was that Baudet being victorious, he would, and having rid himself of the most annoying liberals, he would start going for a more nationalist course. But he's instead done the opposite, emphasizing his friendship for Israel, emphasizing how much they like gay rights, and emphasizing how much they are for liberal values, and so on and so on.
Yeah, that's disappointing.
And as for AfD, it's sort of similar. AfD was torn apart in the same way as between a conflict of the more nationalist and the more liberal side. And I think the same thing sort of happened. The liberals eventually gave up and the nationalist side won. So kind of similar, yeah, I guess.
Okay. Somebody's asking, what's the latest with Black Pete?
Ah, yeah, so this used to be our national... So we used to have a national holiday in which we give children presents. And the last few years, we've had a national holiday in which we discuss whether or not one of the people giving the children presents should be black or not. It's basically been lost at this point. All the media and the major city councils have all started not using Black Pete, instead using rainbow colored or whatever else colors. And Black Pete still used in smaller towns, in towns where they don't fall for this global homo sort of stuff. But in the media, in the big cities, it's gone. And they've resorted, like last year and the year before, there were big street fights and lots of people got injured. This year, there were some conflicts on the streets where there were a few sort of Black Lives Matter type guys protesting against Black Pete, and they were intimidated and assaulted. Because it's extremely unpopular, this anti-Black Pete stuff. It's I wrote an article on Countercurrents once, why Black Pete has sort of been the embodiment of national resistance for the Dutch, because it's just, it's been one step too far for a lot of Dutch people that they're going to after this children's party. And there have been fights. People have been injured, sent to hospital. I think a few police stations were even stormed last year. So it's caused a lot of controversy, a lot of fighting. And this year they resorted to just holding it in the parade in secret. And their police presence is massive now. And it's, they've really decided to end this discussion because it was causing too much trouble. And they've decided, obviously, in favor of the Black Lives Matter side.
Not the Black Pete matter.
Yes, the Black Pete question.
All right. Well, I don't think there are any more questions, so I guess we should end it there.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a wee bit of, shorter than I imagined it being, but
yeah. What I do can you have looked through the chat?
Well, hold on. I mean, there is the DLive chat as well. But, some people are just joining from. Yeah. Okay. So, would you say that? That the Netherlands is in a better position than, for example, Germany in the near future?
Yeah, we are, but it's like you were in a better position in the 90s, weren't you? And you still got to where you are now. It's, we're a bit of a time delay on some things, but it's still going the same direction, all in all. And we're, relatively speaking, still a small country. You've got it. We're economically quite strong. We've got a fairly large population for our country size, but our birth rate's in the toilet, although not as bad as some countries. I think it's 1.7 versus, for example, 1.1 in Italy. And we have our Bible Belt, which is a sort of national redoubt against all these things. But even they are slowly... They used to be of the position that no women were allowed in the electoral rolls. They were, by court order, forced to allow them. So now they have one woman on the electoral roll. You know, it's getting worse and worse even there, the Calvinists. So... Yeah, we're in a better position, but unless things start changing, unless there's a reverse course worldwide, and especially in the USA, because the USA dictates culture, things are going to go downhill here too, and we'll just have a little bit longer to sit it out, I guess. And I was really See, I didn't want to care about U.S. election because it's just not one of these things. But I'm still kind of worried because Biden won. And I don't think it's at this point worth discussing whether Trump's going to take it back, because there's no chance. From the beginning, I said that they would never allow him back in. And with Biden, I expect repressions. I expect American nationalists are going to have a very hard time, at least the next year. They're going to face a lot of repercussions. Things are going to get shut down. And that'll, because America's the cultural dominator, they'll also do that here. There'll also be repression here. And the media always takes its key from its ideas from the American media. So I fear that things are going to get a lot worse the next coming year, at least.
Okay. I mean, I remember saying in the Akenbrand speech in 2017, 1 hour from now it was called, and I remember saying then the next 10 years are going to be very bad. The next 10 years are going to be very difficult, very hard. But hopefully by the end of that time, we will have our own things set up so that we will be more robust, and there will be more of a dissident movement, an infrastructure globally to support the movement, or things will have been resolved to some extent in the national context, that we will have asserted our right to free to speak and to be accepted, and I still think that's the case. I still think that 10 years, like, from then on, so another 7 years, but it is going to be horrible. And you know, those words are easily said. The reality of it could be fucking terrible.
I was actually quite hopeful at the beginning of this year because of all the activism going on in England. All the, you have a lot of YouTubers. I think in that sense, like as a movement, I think the UK at this moment is doing relatively okay. Needs a lot of work. Everything needs a lot of work, obviously. But
yeah,
I think if we all just start, like, one of the things is, I follow these discussions you Anglos have between each other, because I try to keep up with how it happens in Europe. And there's people arguing about Churchill who are pro-white, who are pro-British, and they're arguing about whether or not Churchill was the good or the bad guy, and all this stuff. And I think this is so completely irrelevant when we're looking down the barrel of a gun at this point, and you're arguing about things from 80 years ago. If you want to get anything done, you're going to have to work together and overcome some differences. I'm not a fascist, but I'm not going to be spending most of my time attacking their ideas. I mean, there's plenty of people already doing that. They don't need to help them.
Yeah. I always think we should look at, would our enemies want us to be doing this thing that we're considering doing? Would it please our enemies? Because if it would, odds are we probably shouldn't do it. That's a general rule of thumb for me. All right, someone just on a last final note, someone says, fuck me, if Holland left the EU, I would move there. But I'm guessing that you wouldn't want foreigners.
No, so fuck off.
Okay.
We're full. We've already got a housing shortage. Go away. Do you know what a house costs here?
Oh, all right, you've triggered them. All right, okay.
300,000 euros. The average housing price, goddammit.
Jesus, it's similar here. All right, let's leave it there.
In London, maybe this is the entire country. That's the average price for the entire country.
That's crazy.
You want to buy a house in Amsterdam? It'll cost you €500,000.
I can imagine it, but then again, it's only the best people live in Amsterdam.
Oh yeah, the best, the greatest, absolutely. Yeah. So if you ever, coming back over, we'll of course meet up and do some. You've removed a lot of the content we did together. It's really unfortunate.
Well, that's in a perhaps vain attempt to save my channel. I am sorry about that, but it is all on BitChute, and hopefully okay. BitChute will grow. So,
you can see us at the red light districts then over on Woz's BitChute.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's all there. If it's not, I'll be doing that in the new year anyway, filling it up with all the old videos.
So, I'll be checking.
All right. Okay, well, this was Faust, and you can find him on YouTube. I'll link to your other channel as well, to the Dutch channel. I think I've only linked to your English channel, so I'll link to both of them. And all right. Okay, well, excellent. I think this is a good one. So thanks very much.
Good talking to you again.
Yeah, it's nice. Good to catch up. All right. Well, I'll be back in 50 minutes with Martin Lichtmess. I think that's right. Let me just check. Yes, it is. And I'll see you then. In the meantime, Faust, thank you for taking part in Millennial 20.
I'll have a question ready for him immediately. Well, how does he feel about getting the Holy Roman Empire back together?
All right. I think, yeah, we'll see what he says. Okay, see you later. Bye for now.